said Famine. I like winter. There's something clean about winter. Chickens coming home to roost, said War.
No more chickens, said Famine flatly.
Only death hadn't changed. Some things don't. The four left the building. It was noticeable that pollution, while still walking, nevertheless gave the impression of oozing. And this was noticed by Anathema and Newton Pulsifer. It had been the first building they'd come to. It had seemed much safer inside than out, where there seemed to be a lot of excitement. Anathema had pushed open a door covered in signs that suggested that this would be a terminally dangerous thing to do. It had swung open at her touch. When they'd gone inside, it had shut and locked itself. There hadn't been a lot of time to discuss this after the four had walked in.
What were they? Said Newt. Some kind of terrorists?
In a very nice and accurate sense, said Anathema, I think you're right.
What was all that weird talk about?
I think possibly the end of the world, said Anathema. Did you see their auras?
Well, I don't think so, said Newt.
Not nice at all.
Oh?
Negative auras, in fact.
Oh?
Like black holes.
That's bad, is it?
Yes. Anathema glared at the rows of metal cabinets. For once, just now, because it wasn't just for play, but was for real, the machinery that was going to bring about the end of the world, or at least that part of it that occupied the layers between about 2 meters down and all the way to the ozone layer, wasn't operating according to the usual script. There were no big red canisters with flashing lights. There were no coiled wires with a cut-me look about them. No suspiciously large numeric displays were counting down toward a zero that could be averted with seconds to spare. Instead, the metal cabinets looked solid and heavy, and very resistant to last-minute heroism.
What takes its course? Said Anathema. They've done something, haven't they?
Perhaps there's an off switch, said Newt, helplessly.
I'm sure if we looked around. These sort of things are wired in, don't be silly. I thought you knew about this sort of thing.
Newt nodded desperately. This was a long way from the pages of Easy Electronics. For the look of the thing, he peered into the back of one of the cabinets.
Worldwide communications, he said, indistinctly. You could do practically anything. Modulate the mains power, tap into satellites. Absolutely anything. You could zip, yuck, you could zap, ouch, make things zip, just about zap, ooh.
How are you getting on in there? Newt sucked his fingers. So far he hadn't found anything that resembled a transistor. He wrapped his hand in his handkerchief and pulled a couple of boards out of their sockets. Once, one of the electronics magazines to which he subscribed had published a joke circuit which was guaranteed not to work. At last, they'd said, in an amusing way, here's something all you ham-fisted hams out there can build, in the certain knowledge that if it does nothing, it's working. It had diodes the wrong way round, transistors upside down, and a flat battery. Newt had built it, and it picked up Radio Moscow. He'd written them a letter of complaint, but they never replied.
I really don't know if I'm doing any good, he said.
James Bond just unscrews things, said Anathema.
Not just unscrews, said Newt, his temper fraying. And I'm not
James Bond.
If I was Whizzle,
the bad guys would have shown me all the Megadeth levers and told me how they bloody well worked, wouldn't they?
Only it doesn't happen like that in real life. I don't know what's happening, and I can't stop it.
Clouds churned around the horizon. Overhead, the sky was still clear, the air torn by nothing more than a light breeze. But it wasn't normal air. It had a crystallized look to it, so that you might feel that if you turned your head, you might see new facets. It sparkled. If you had to find a word to describe it,
The word thronged might slip insidiously into your mind. Thronged with insubstantial beings awaiting only the right moment to become very substantial.
Adam glanced up.
In one sense, there was just clear air overhead. In another, stretching off to infinity, were the hosts of heaven and hell, wingtip to wingtip. If you looked really closely, and had been specially trained, you could tell the difference. Silence held the bubble of the world in its grip. The door of the building swung open, and the four stepped out. There was no more than a hint of human about three of them now. They seemed to be humanoid shapes made up of all the things they were or represented. They made Death seem positively homely. His leather greatcoat and dark-visored helmet had become a cowled robe, but these were mere details. A skeleton, even a walking one, is at least human. Death of a sort lurks inside every living creature.
The thing is, said Adam urgently, they're not really real. They're just like nightmares, really.
But we're not asleep, said Pepper.
Dog whined and tried to hide behind Adam.
That one looks as if he's melting, said Brian, pointing at the advancing figure, if such it could still be called, of pollution.
Well, there you are, then, said Adam encouragingly. It can't be real, can it? It's common sense.
Something like that can't be really real.
The four halted a few meters away.
It has been done, said Death.
He leaned forward a little and stared eyelessly at Adam. It was hard to tell if he was surprised.
Yes, well, said Adam, the thing is, I don't want it done. I never asked for it to be done.
Death looked at the other three, and then back to Adam. Behind them a jeep skewed to a halt. They ignored it.
I do not understand, he said. Surely your very existence requires the ending of the world. It is written.
I don't see why anyone has to go and write things like that, said Adam calmly. The world is full of all sorts of brilliant stuff, and I haven't found out all about it yet. So I don't want anyone messing it about or ending it before I've had a chance to find out about it. So you can all just go away.
That's the one, Mr. Shadwell, said Aziraphale, his words trailing into uncertainty even as he uttered them. The one with the T-shirt.
Death stared at Adam.
You are part of us, said War between teeth like beautiful bullets.
It is done. We make the world anew, said Pollution, his voice as insidious as something leaking out of a corroded drum into a water table. You lead us, said Famine.
And Adam hesitated. Voices inside him still cried out that this was true, and that the world was his as well, and all he had to do was turn and lead them out across a bewildered planet.
They were his kind of people.
In tears above, the hosts of the sky waited for the word.
You cannot want me to shoot him. He's but a Ben.
Said Aziraphale. Yes. Perhaps we'd just better wait a bit. What do you think?
What, until he grows up, do you mean? Said Crowley.
Dog began to growl.
Adam looked at the them. They were his kind of people, too. You just had to decide who your friends really were.
He turned back to the four.
Get them, said Adam quietly.
The slouch and slur were gone from his voice. It had strange harmonics. No one human could disobey a voice like that. War laughed and looked expectantly at the them.
Little boys, she said, playing with your toys. Think of all the toys I can offer you. Think of all the games. I can make you fall in love with me, little boys. Little boys, with your little guns.
She laughed again, but the machine gun stutter died away as Pepper stepped forward and raised a trembling arm. It wasn't much of a sword, but it was about the best you could do with two bits of wood and a piece of string. War stared at it.
I see, she said. Mano a mano, eh?
She drew her own blade and brought it up so that it made a noise like a finger being dragged around a wine glass. There was a flash as they connected. Death stared into Adam's eyes. There was a pathetic jingling noise.
Don't touch it, snapped Adam without moving his head.
The them stared at the sword rocking to a standstill on the concrete path.
Little boys, muttered Pepper disgustedly. Sooner or later, everyone has to decide which gang they belong to.
But, said Brian, she sort of got sucked up the sword.
The air between Adam and Death began to vibrate, as in a heat wave. Wensleydale raised his head and looked famine in the sunken eye. He held up something that, with a bit of imagination, could be considered to be a pair of scales made of more string and twigs. Then he whirled it around his head. Famine stuck out a protective arm. There was another flash, and then the jingle of a pair of silver scales bouncing on the ground.
Don't touch them, said Adam.
Pollution had already started to run, or at least to flow quickly, but Brian snatched the circle of grass stalks from his own head and flung it. It shouldn't have handled like one, but a force took it out of his hands, and it whirred like a discus. This time the explosion was a red flame inside a billow of black smoke, and it smelled of oil. With a rolling, tinny little sound, a blackened silver crown bowled out of the smoke, and then spun round with a noise like a settling penny. At least they needed no warning about touching it. It glistened in a way that metal should not.
Where'd they go? Said Wensley.
Where they belong, said Death, still holding Adam's gaze. Where they have always been. Back in the minds of man.
He grinned at Adam. There was a tearing sound. Death's robe split and his wings unfolded. Angel's wings, but not of feathers. They were wings of night, wings that were shapes cut through the matter of creation into the darkness underneath, in which a few distant lights glimmered, lights that may have been stars, or may have been something entirely else.
But I, he said, am not like them. I am Azrael, created to be creation's shadow. You cannot destroy me. That would destroy the world.
The heat of their stare faded. Adam scratched his nose.
Oh, I don't know, he said. There might be a way.
He grinned back. Anyway, it's going to stop now, he said. All this stuff with machines. You've got to do what I say just for now, and I say it's got to stop.
Death shrugged. It is stopping already, he said. Without them, he indicated the pathetic remnants of the other three horsepersons, it cannot proceed. Normal entropy triumphs.
Death raised a bony hand in what might have been a salute.
They'll be back, he said. They're never far away.
The wings flapped just once like a thunderclap, and the angel of death vanished.
Right then, said Adam, to the empty air. All right. It's not going to happen. All the stuff they started, it must stop now.
Newt stared desperately at the equipment racks.
You'd think there'd be a manual or something, he said. We could see if Agnes has anything to say, volunteered Anathema.
Oh, yes, said Newt bitterly. That makes sense, does it? Sabotaging 20th century electronics with the aid of a 17th century workshop manual. What did Agnes Nutter know of the transistor? Well, my grandfather interpreted prediction 3328 rather neatly in 1948 and made some very shrewd investments, said Anathema. She didn't know what it was going to be called, of course, and she wasn't very sound about electricity in general, but I was speaking rhetorically. You don't have to make it work, anyway. You have to stop it working. You don't need knowledge for that. You need ignorance. Newt groaned. All right, he said wearily. Let's try it. Give me a prediction. Anathema pulled out a card at random. He is not that which he says he is, she read. It's number 1002. Very simple. Any ideas? Well, look, said Newt wretchedly. This isn't really the time to say it, but, he swallowed. Actually, I'm not very good with electronics. Not very good at all. You said you were a computer engineer, I seem to remember. Well, that was an exaggeration. I mean, just about as much of an exaggeration as you can possibly get, in fact, really. I suppose it was more what you might call an overstatement. I might go so far as to say that what it really was, Newt closed his eyes, was a prevarication.
A lie, you mean?
Said Anathema, sweetly. Oh, I wouldn't go that far, said Newt. Although, he added, I'm not actually a computer engineer at all. Quite the opposite.
What's the opposite?
If you must know, every time I try and make anything electronic work, it stops. Anathema gave him a bright little smile and posed theatrically, like that moment in every conjurer's stage act when the lady in the sequins steps back to reveal the trick.
Tra-la, she said.
Repair it, she said. What?
Make it work better, she said.
Well, I don't know, said Newt. I'm not sure I can. He laid a hand on top of the nearest cabinet. There was the noise of something he hadn't realized he'd been hearing suddenly stopping, and the descending whine of a distant generator. The lights on the panels flickered, and most of them went out. All over the world, people who had been wrestling with switches found that they switched. Circuit breakers opened. Computers stopped planning World War III and went back to idly scanning the stratosphere. In bunkers under Novaya Zemlya, men found that the fuses they were frantically trying to pull out came away in their hands at last. In bunkers under Wyoming and Nebraska, men in fatigues stopped screaming and waving guns at one another, and would have had a beer if alcohol had been allowed in missile bases. It wasn't, but they had one anyway. The lights came on. Civilization stopped its slide into chaos and started writing letters to the newspapers about how people got overexcited about the least little thing these days. In Tadfield, the machines ceased radiating menace. Something that had been in them was gone, quite apart from the electricity.
Gosh, said Newt. There you are, said Anathema. You fixed it good. You can trust old Agnes, take it from me. Now let's get out of here.
He didn't want to do it, said Aziraphale. Haven't I always told you, Crowley? If you take the trouble to look deep down inside anyone, you'll find that at bottom, they're really quite...
It's not over, said Crowley, flatly.
Adam turned and appeared to notice them for the first time. Crowley was not used to people identifying him so readily, but Adam stared at him as though Crowley's entire life history was pasted inside the back of his skull, and he... Adam was reading it. For an instant, he knew real terror. He'd always thought the sort he'd felt before was the genuine article. But that was mere abject fear beside this new sensation. Those below could make you cease to exist by, well, hurting you in unbearable amounts. But this boy could not only make you cease to exist merely by thinking about it, but probably could arrange matters so that you never had existed at all. Adam's gaze swept to Aziraphale.
"Excuse me, why are you two people?" said Adam.
"Well," said Aziraphale, "it's not right being two people.
said Adam. I reckon you better go back to being two separate people. There were no showy special effects. There was just Aziraphale sitting next to Madame Tracy.
Oh, that felt tingly, she said.
She looked Aziraphale up and down.
Oh, she said, in a slightly disappointed voice. Somehow I thought you'd be younger.
Shadwell glowered jealously at the angel and thumbed the Thundergun's hammer in a pointed sort of way. Aziraphale looked down at his new body, which was, unfortunately, very much like his old body, although the overcoat was cleaner.
Well, that's over, he said.
No, said Crowley, no, it isn't, you see. Not at all. Now there were clouds overhead, curling like a pot of tagliatelle on full boil. You see, said Crowley, his voice leaden with fatalistic gloom, it doesn't really work that simply. You think wars get started because some old duke gets shot, or someone cuts off someone's ear, or someone sighted their missiles in the wrong place. It's not like that. That's just, well, just reasons which haven't got anything to do with it. What really causes wars is two sides that can't stand the sight of one another, and the pressure builds up and up, and then anything will cause it, anything at all. What's your name, boy?
That's Adam Young,
said Anathema, as she strode up with Newt trailing after her. Yeah, that's right. Adam Young, said Adam.
Yeah, good effort. You've saved the world. Have a half holiday, said Crowley. But it won't really make any difference.
I think you're right, said Aziraphale. I'm sure my people want Armageddon. It's very sad.
Would anyone mind telling us what's going on? Said Anathema sternly, folding her arms.
Aziraphale shrugged. It's a very long story, he began.
Anathema stuck out her chin. Go on, then, she said.
Well, in the beginning, the lightning flashed, struck the ground a few meters from Adam, and stayed there, a sizzling column that broadened at the base, as though the wild electricity was filling an invisible mold. The humans pressed back against the jeep. The lightning vanished, and a young man made out of golden fire stood there.
Oh, dear, said Aziraphale. It's him.
Him who? Said Crowley.
The voice of God, said the angel, the Metatron.
The them stared.
Then Pepper said, no, it isn't. The Metatron's made of plastic, and it's got laser cannon, and it can turn into a helicopter.
That's the Cosmic Megatron, said Wensleydale weakly. I had one, but the head fell off. I think this one is different.
The beautiful blank gaze fell on Adam Young, and then turned sharply to look at the concrete beside it, which was boiling. A figure rose from the churning ground in the manner of the Demon King in a pantomime. But if this one was ever in a pantomime, it was one where no one walked out alive, and they had to get a priest to burn the place down afterwards. It was not greatly different to the other figure, except that its flames were blood red.
Said Crowley, trying to shrink into his seat. Hi.
The red thing gave him the briefest of glances, as though marking him for future consumption, and then stared at Adam. When it spoke, its voice was like a million flies taking off in a hurry.
It buzzed a word that felt to those humans who heard it like a file dragged down the spine.
It was talking to Adam, who said,
I said already my name's Adam Young.
He looked the figure up and down.
What's yours?
Beelzebub, Crowley supplied.
He's the lord of... Thank you, Crowley. Said Beelzebub. Later we must have a serious talk. I'm sure thou hast much to tell me.
Said Crowley. Well, you see, what happened was...
Silence.
Oh, right, said Crowley, hurriedly.
Now then, Adam Young,
said the Metatron.
While we can, of course, appreciate your assistance at this point, we must add that Armageddon should take place now. There may be some temporary inconvenience, but that should hardly stand in the way of the ultimate good.
Ah, whispered Crowley to Aziraphale. What he means is, we have to destroy the world in order to save it.
As to what it stands in the way of, that has yet to be decided, buzzed Beelzebub. But it must be decided now, boy. That is thy destiny. It is written.
Adam took a deep breath. The human watchers held theirs. Crowley and Aziraphale had forgotten to breathe some time ago.
I just don't see why everyone and everything has to be burned up and everything, Adam said. Millions of fish and whales and trees and sheep and stuff. And not even for anything important, just to see who's got the best gang. It's like us and the Johnsonites. But even if you win, you can't really beat the other side because you don't really want to. I mean, not for good. You'll just start all over again. Just keep on sending people like these two, he pointed to Crowley and Aziraphale, to mess people around. It's hard enough being people as it is, without other people coming and messing you around.
Crowley turned to Aziraphale. Johnsonites? He whispered. The angel shrugged. Early breakaway sect, I think, he said. Sort of Gnostics, like the Ophites. His forehead wrinkled. Or were they the Sethites? No, I'm thinking of the Colliridians, oh dear. I'm sorry, there were hundreds of them. It's so hard to keep track.
People being messed around, murmured Crowley.
It doesn't matter, snapped the Metatron. The whole point of the creation of the Earth and good and evil...
I don't see what's so terrific about creating people as people, and then getting upset because they act like people, said Adam severely. Anyway, if you stop telling people it's all sorted out after they're dead, they might try sorting it out while they're alive. If I was in charge, I'd try making people live a lot longer, like old Methuselah. It'd be a lot more interesting. And they might start thinking about the sort of things they're doing to all the environment and ecology, because they'll still be around in 100 years' time.
Yeah, said Beelzebub, and he actually began to smile. You wish to rule the world? That's more like thy father.
I thought about all that, and I don't want to, said Adam, half turning and nodding encouragingly at the them. I mean, there's some stuff could do with altering, but then I expect people would keep coming up to me and getting me to sort out everything the whole time, and get rid of all the rubbish and make more trees for them. And where's the good in all that? It's like having to tidy up people's bedrooms for them.
You never tidy up even your bedroom, said Pepper behind him.
I never said anything about my bedroom, said Adam, referring to a room whose carpet had been lost to view for several years. It's general bedrooms, I mean. I didn't mean my personal bedroom. It's an analogy. That's just what I'm saying.
Beelzebub and the Metatron looked at one another.
Anyway, said Adam, it's bad enough having to think of things for Pepper and Wensley and Brian to do all the time so they don't get bored. So I don't want any more world than I've got. Thank you all the same.
The Metatron's face began to take on the look familiar to all those subjected to Adam's idiosyncratic line of reasoning.
You can't refuse to be who you are,
it said eventually.
Listen, your birth and destiny are part of the great plan. Things have to happen like this. All the choices have been made.
Rebellion is a fine thing, said Beelzebub, but some things are beyond rebellion. You must understand.
I'm not rebelling against anything, said Adam in a reasonable tone of voice. I'm pointing out things. Seems to me you can't blame people for pointing out things. Seems to me it'd be a lot better not to start fighting and just see what people do. If you stop messing them about, they might start thinking properly. And they might stop messing the world around. I'm not saying they would, he added conscientiously, but they might.
This makes no sense, said the Metatron. You can't run counter to the great plan. You must think. It's in your genes. Think.
Adam hesitated. The dark undercurrent was always ready to flow back, its reedy whisper saying, yes, that was it. That was what it was all about. You have to follow the plan because you were part of it. It had been a long day. He was tired. Saving the world took it out of an 11-year-old body. Crowley stuck his head in his hands.
For a moment there, just for a moment, I thought we had a chance, he said. He had them worried. Oh, well, it was nice, well...
He was aware that Aziraphale had stood up.
Excuse me, said the angel. The trio looked at him. This great plan, he said, this would be the ineffable plan, would it?
There was a moment's silence.
It's the great plan,
said the Metatron flatly.
You are well aware. There shall be a world lasting 6,000 years, and it will conclude with...
Yes, yes, that's the great plan, all right, said Aziraphale. He spoke politely and respectfully, but with the air of one who has just asked an unwelcome question at a political meeting and won't go away until he gets an answer. I was just asking if it's ineffable as well. I just want to be clear on this point.
It doesn't matter,
snapped the Metatron.
It's the same thing, surely.
Surely, thought Crowley. They don't actually know. He started to grin like an idiot.
So you're not 100% clear on this? Said Aziraphale.
It's not given to us to understand the ineffable plan,
said the Metatron.
But of course, the great plan...
But the great plan can only be a tiny part of the overall ineffability, said Crowley. You can't be certain that what's happening right now isn't exactly right from an ineffable point of view.
It is written, bellowed Beelzebub.
But it might be written differently somewhere else, said Crowley, where you can't read it. In bigger letters, said Aziraphale.
Underlined, Crowley added.
Twice, suggested Aziraphale. Perhaps this isn't just a test of the world, said Crowley. It might be a test of you people, too. Hmm?
God does not play games with his loyal servants,
said the Metatron, but in a worried tone of voice.
Woo-hee, said Crowley. Where have you been?
Everyone found their eyes turning toward Adam. He seemed to be thinking very carefully. Then he said,
I don't see why it matters what is written. Not when it's about people. It can always be crossed out.
A breeze swept across the airfield. Overhead, the assembled hosts rippled like a mirage. There was the kind of silence there might have been on the day before creation. Adam stood smiling at the two of them, a small figure perfectly poised exactly between heaven and hell. Crowley grabbed Aziraphale's arm.
You know what happened? He hissed excitedly. He was left alone. He grew up human. He's not evil incarnate or good incarnate. He's just a human incarnate.
Then...
I think, said the Metatron, that I shall need to seek further instructions.
I also, said Beelzebub.
His raging face turned to Crowley.
And I shall report of your part in this, thou hast better believe it.
He glared at Adam.
And I do not know what thy father will say.
There was a thundering explosion. Shadwell, who had been fidgeting with horrified excitement for some minutes, had finally got enough control of his trembling fingers to pull the trigger. The pellets passed through the space where Beelzebub had been. Shadwell never knew how lucky he had been that he'd missed. The sky wavered, and then became just sky. Around the horizon, the clouds began to unravel. Madame Tracy broke the silence.
Weren't they odd?
She said. She didn't mean, weren't they odd? What she did mean, she probably could never hope to express, except by screaming. But the human brain has amazing recuperative powers, and saying, weren't they odd, was part of the rapid healing process. Within half an hour, she'd be thinking she'd just had too much to drink.
Is it over, do you think? Said Aziraphale.
Crowley shrugged.
Not for us, I'm afraid. I don't think you need to go worrying,
said Adam gnomically. I know all about you two. Don't you worry. He looked at the rest of the them, who tried not to back away. He seemed to think for a while. And then he said, There's been too much messing around anyway. But it seems to me everyone's going to be a lot happier if they forget about this. Not actually forget, just not remember exactly. And then we can go home.
But you can't just leave it at that, said Anathema, pushing forward. Think of all the things you could do. Good things.
Like what? Said Adam suspiciously.
Well, you could bring all the whales back to start with.
He put his head on one side. And that'd stop people killing them, would it? She hesitated. It would have been nice to say yes. And if people do start killing them, what would you ask me to do about them? Said Adam. No, I reckon I'm getting the hang of this now. Once I start messing around like that, there'll be no stopping it. Seems to me the only sensible thing is for people to know if they kill a whale, they've got a dead whale.
That shows a very responsible attitude, said Newt.
Adam raised an eyebrow. It's just sense, he said.
Aziraphale patted Crowley on the back.
We seem to have survived, he said. Just imagine how terrible it might have been if we'd been at all competent.
Yeah, said Crowley.
Is your car operational?
I think it might need a bit of work, Crowley admitted.
I was thinking that we might take these good people into town, said Aziraphale. I owe Madame Tracy a meal, I'm sure. And her young man, of course.
Shadwell looked over his shoulder, and then up at Madame Tracy.
Who's he talking about?
He asked her triumphant expression. Adam rejoined the them.
I reckon we'll just be getting home, he said.
But what actually happened? Said Pepper. I mean, there was all this...
It doesn't matter anymore, said Adam.
But you could help so much, Anathema began as they wandered back to their bikes.
Newt took her gently by the arm.
That's not a good idea, he said. Tomorrow is the first day of the rest of our lives. Do you know, she said, of all the trite sayings I've ever really hated, that comes top.
Amazing, isn't it?
Said Newt, happily.
Why have you got Dick Turpin painted on the door of your car?
It's a joke, really, said Newt.
Hmm? Because everywhere I go, I hold up traffic, he mumbled wretchedly.
Crowley looked glumly at the controls of the jeep.
I'm sorry about the car, Aziraphale was saying. I know how much you liked it. Perhaps if you concentrated really hard, it wouldn't be the same, said Crowley.
I suppose not.
I had it from you, you know. It wasn't a car, it was more a sort of whole body glove.
He sniffed. What's burning? He said. A breeze swept up the dust and dropped it again. The air became hot and heavy, imprisoning those within it like flies in syrup. He turned his head and looked into Aziraphale's horrified expression.
But it's over, he said.
It can't happen now. The thing, the correct moment or whatever, it's gone past, it's over.
The ground began to shake. The noise was like a subway train, but not one passing under, it was more like the sound of one coming up.
Crowley fumbled madly with the gear shift.
That's not Beelzebub, he shouted above the noise of the wind. That's him, his father. This isn't Armageddon, this is personal. Start, you bloody thing.
The ground moved under Anathema and Newt, flinging them onto the dancing concrete. Yellow smoke gushed from between the cracks.
It feels like a volcano, shouted Newt. What is it?
Whatever it is, it's pretty angry, said Anathema.
In the jeep, Crowley was cursing. Aziraphale laid a hand on his shoulder.
There are humans here, he said.
Yes, said Crowley, and me.
I mean, we shouldn't let this happen to them.
Well, what?
Crowley began and stopped.
I mean, when you think about it, we've got them into enough trouble as it is, you and me, over the years, what with one thing and another.
We were only doing our jobs, muttered Crowley.
Yes, so what? Lots of people in history have only done their jobs, and look at the trouble they caused.
Well, you don't mean we should actually try to stop him.
What have you got to lose?
Crowley started to argue,
and realized that he hadn't anything. There was nothing he could lose that he hadn't lost already. They couldn't do anything worse to him than he had coming to him already. He felt free at last. He also felt under the seat and found a tire iron. It wouldn't be any good, but then nothing would. In fact, it'd be much more terrible facing the adversary with anything like a decent weapon. That way, you might have a bit of hope which would make it worse. Aziraphale picked up the sword lately dropped by war and hefted its weight thoughtfully.
"Gosh, it's been years since I used this," he murmured.
"About 6,000, said Crowley.
"My word, yes," said the angel. "What a day that was, and no mistake. Good old days."
"Not really," said Crowley. The noise was growing.
"People knew the difference between right and wrong in those days," said Aziraphale dreamily.
"Well, yes. Think about it."
"Ah, yes. Too much messing about?"
"Yes." Aziraphale held up the sword. There was a whoof as it suddenly flamed like a bar of magnesium.
"Once you've learned how to do it, you never forget," he said.
He smiled at Crowley.
"I'd just like to say," he said, "if we don't get out of this, that I'll have known deep down inside that there was a spark of goodness in you."
"Yeah, that's right," said Crowley bitterly. "Make my day." Aziraphale held out his hand.
"Nice knowing you," he said.
Crowley took it.
"Here's to the next time," he said.
"Oh, and, Aziraphale?"
"Yes?"
"Just remember, I'll have known that deep down inside, you were just enough of a bastard to be worth liking."
There was a scuffling noise, and they were pushed aside by the small but dynamic shape of Shadwell, waving the thunder gun purposefully.
"I wouldn't trust you two southern Nancy boys to kill a lame rat in a barrel," he said. "Who are we fighting now?"
"The devil," said Aziraphale, simply.
Shadwell nodded, as if this hadn't come as a surprise, threw the gun down, and took off his hat to expose a forehead known and feared wherever street-fighting men were gathered together.
"I reckon so," he said. "In that case, I'm gonna use my head."
Newt and Anathema watched the three of them walk unsteadily away from the jeep. With Shadwell in the middle, they looked like a stylized W.
"What on earth are they going to do?" said Newt. "And what's happening? What's happening to them?"
The coats of Aziraphale and Crowley split along the seams. If you were going to go, you might as well go in your own true shape, feathers unfolded towards the sky. Contrary to popular belief, the wings of demons are the same as the wings of angels, although they're often better groomed.
"Shadwell shouldn't be going with them," said Newt,
staggering to his feet.
"What's a Shadwell?" "He's my sergeant. Well, he's this amazing old man. You'd never believe it. I've got to help him."
"Help him?" said Anathema.
"Well, I took an oath and everything."
Newt hesitated.
"Well, sort of an oath. And he gave me a month's wages in advance." "Who are those other two, then? Friends of yours?"
Anathema began, and stopped. Aziraphale had half turned, and the profile had finally clicked into place.
"I know where I've seen him before," she shouted, pulling herself upright against Newt as the ground bounced up and down. "Come on. But something dreadful's gonna happen. If he's damaged the book, you're bloody well right."
Newt fumbled in his lapel and found his official pin. He didn't know what they were going up against this time, but a pin was all he had. They ran. Adam looked around. He looked down. His face took on an expression of calculated innocence. There was a moment of conflict, but Adam was on his own ground. Always and ultimately on his own ground. He moved one hand around in a blurred half-circle. Aziraphale and Crowley felt the world change. There was no noise. There were no cracks. There was just that where there had been the beginnings of a volcano of satanic power,
There was just clearing smoke, and a car drawing slowly to a halt, its engine loud in the evening hush. It was an elderly car, but well-preserved. Not using Crowley's method, though, where dents were simply wished away. This car looked like it did, you knew instinctively, because its owner had spent every weekend for 2 decades doing all the things the manual said should be done every weekend. Before every journey, he walked around it and checked the lights and counted the wheels. Serious-minded men who smoked pipes and wore moustaches had written serious instructions saying that this should be done, and so he did it, because he was a serious-minded man who smoked a pipe and wore a moustache, and did not take such injunctions lightly. Because if you did, where would you be? He had exactly the right amount of insurance. He drove 3 miles below the speed limit, or 40 miles per hour, whichever was the lower. He wore a tie, even on Saturdays. Archimedes said that with a long enough lever and a solid enough place to stand, he could move the world. He could have stood on Mr. Young. The car door opened, and Mr. Young emerged.
"What's going on here?" he said. "Adam? Adam!"
But the them was streaking towards the gate. Mr. Young looked at the shocked assembly. At least Crowley and Aziraphale had had enough self-control left to winch in their wings.
"What's he been getting up to now?" he sighed, not really expecting an answer. "Where's that boy got to? Adam, come back here this instant!"
Adam seldom did what his father wanted. Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger opened his eyes. The only thing strange about his surroundings was how familiar they were. There was his high school photograph on the wall, and his little Stars and Stripes flag in the tooth mug next to his toothbrush, and even his little teddy bear still in its little uniform. The early afternoon sun flooded through his bedroom window. He could smell apple pie. That was one of the things he'd missed most about spending his Saturday nights a long way from home. He walked downstairs. His mother was at the stove, taking a huge apple pie out of the oven to cool.
"Hi, Tommy," she said. "I thought you was in England."
"Yes, Mom. I am normatively in England, Mom, protecting democratism, Mom, sir," said Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger.
"That's nice, hon," said his mother. "Your papa's down in the big field with Chester and Ted. They'll be pleased to see you."
Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger nodded. He took off his military-issue helmet and his military-issue jacket, and he rolled up his military-issue shirt sleeves. For a moment he looked more thoughtful than he had ever done in his life. Part of his thoughts were occupied with apple pie.
"Mom, if any throughput eventuates premising to interface with Sergeant Thomas A. Deisenberger telephonically, Mom, sir, this individual will be..."
"Sorry, Tommy?"
Tom Deisenberger hung his gun on the wall above his father's battered old rifle.
"I said, if anyone calls, Mom, I'll be down in the big field with Pop and Chester and Ted."
The van drove slowly up to the gates of the airbase. It pulled over. The guard on the midnight shift looked in the window, checked the credentials of the driver, and waved him in. The van meandered across the concrete. It parked on the tarmac of the empty airstrip, near where 2 men sat sharing a bottle of wine. One of the men wore dark glasses. Surprisingly, no one else seemed to be paying them the slightest attention.
"Are you saying," said Crowley, "that he planned it this way all along, from the very beginning?"
Aziraphale conscientiously wiped the top of the bottle and passed it back.
"Could have," he said, "could have. One could always ask him, I suppose."
"From what I remember," replied Crowley thoughtfully, "and we were never actually on what you might call speaking terms, he wasn't exactly one for a straight answer. In fact, he'd never answer at all. He'd just smile as if he knew something that you didn't."
"And of course that's true," said the angel. "Otherwise, what'd be the point?"
There was a pause, and both beings stared reflectively off into the distance, as if they were remembering things that neither of them had thought of for a long time. The van driver got out of the van, carrying a cardboard box and a pair of tongs. Lying on the tarmac were a tarnished metal crown and a pair of scales. The man picked them up with the tongs and placed them in the box. Then he approached the couple with the bottle.
"Excuse me, gents," he said, "but there's meant to be a sword around here somewhere as well. At least that's what it says here at any rate, and I was wondering..."
Aziraphale seemed embarrassed. He looked around himself, vaguely puzzled, then stood up to discover that he'd been sitting on the sword for the last hour or so. He reached down and picked it up.
Sorry, he said,
and put the sword into the box. The van driver, who wore an International Express cap, said not to mention it, and really it was a godsend, them both being there like this, since someone was going to have to sign to say that he'd duly collected what he'd been sent for. And this had certainly been a day to remember, eh? Aziraphale and Crowley both agreed with him that it had, and Aziraphale signed the clipboard that the van driver gave him, witnessing that a crown, a pair of balances, and a sword had been received in good order and were to be delivered to a smudged address and charged to a blurred account number. The man began to walk back to his van. Then he stopped and turned.
"If I was to tell my wife what happened to me today," he told them, a little sadly, "she'd never believe me. And I wouldn't blame her, because I don't, either."
And he climbed into his van, and he drove away. Crowley stood up a little unsteadily. He reached a hand down to Aziraphale.
"Come on," he said. "I'll drive us back to London."
He took a jeep. No one stopped them. It had a cassette player. This isn't general issue, even for American military vehicles, but Crowley automatically assumed that all vehicles he drove would have cassette players, and therefore this one did within seconds of his getting in. The cassette that he put on as he drove was marked Handel's Water Music, and it stayed Handel's Water Music all the way home. Sunday, the first day of the rest of their lives. At around 10:30, the paper boy brought the Sunday papers to the front door of Jasmine Cottage. He had to make 3 trips. The series of thumps as they hit the mat woke up Newton Pulsifer. He left Anathema asleep. She was pretty shattered, poor thing. She'd been almost incoherent when he'd put her to bed. She'd run her life according to the prophecies, and now there were no more prophecies. She must be feeling like a train which had reached the end of the line, but still had to keep going somehow. From now on, she'd be able to go through life with everything coming as a surprise, just like everyone else. What luck! The telephone rang. Newt dashed for the kitchen and picked up the receiver on the second ring. "Hello," he said. A voice of forced friendliness, tinted with desperation, gabbled at him.
"No," he said, "I'm not. And it's not Davisi, it's device, as in nice. And she's asleep." "Well," he said, "I'm pretty sure she doesn't want any cavities insulated or double glazing. I mean, she doesn't own the cottage, you know, she's only renting it." "No, I'm not going to wake her up and ask her," he said. "And tell me, Miss Morrow, why don't you lot take Sundays off like everybody else does?"
"Sunday," he said.
"Of course it's not Saturday. Why should it be Saturday? Saturday was yesterday. It's honestly Sunday today, really. What do you mean you've lost a day?" "Oh, I haven't got it. Seems to me you've got a bit carried away with selling." "Hello?"
He growled and replaced the receiver. Telephone salespeople. Something dreadful ought to happen to them. he was assailed by a moment of sudden doubt. Today was Sunday, wasn't it? A glance at the Sunday papers reassured him. If the Sunday Times said it was Sunday, you could be sure that they'd investigated the matter. And yesterday was Saturday, of course. Yesterday was Saturday, and he'd never forget Saturday for as long as he lived. If only he could remember what it was he wasn't meant to forget. Seeing that he was in the kitchen, Newt decided to make breakfast. He moved around the kitchen as quietly as possible to avoid waking the rest of the household, and found every sound magnified. The antique fridge had a door that shut like the crack of doom. The kitchen tap dribbled like a diuretic gerbil, but made a noise like Old Faithful. And he couldn't find where anything was. In the end, as every human being who has ever breakfasted on their own in someone else's kitchen has done since nearly the dawn of time, he made do with unsweetened instant black coffee. Footnote. Except for Giovanni Jacopo Casanova, 1725 to 1798, famed amorist and litterateur, who revealed in volume 12 of his memoirs that, as a matter of course, he carried around with him at all times a small valise containing
a loaf of bread, a pot of choice Seville marmalade, a knife, fork and small spoon for stirring, two fresh eggs packed with care in unspun wool, a tomato or love apple, a small frying pan, a small saucepan, a spirit burner, a chafing dish, a tin box of salted butter of the Italian type, two bone china plates, also a portion of honeycomb as a sweetener for my breath and for my coffee. Let my readers understand me when I say to them all, a true gentleman should always be able to break his fast in the manner of a gentleman, wheresoever he may find himself.
On the kitchen table was a roughly rectangular leather-bound cinder. He could just make out the words N-I-E and A-C-C on the charred cover. What a difference a day made, he thought. It turns you from the ultimate reference book to a mere barbecue briquette. Now, then, how exactly had they got it? He recalled a man who smelled of smoke and wore sunglasses even in darkness. And there was other stuff all running together, boys on bikes, an unpleasant buzzing, a small, grubby, staring face. It all hung around in his mind, not exactly forgotten, but forever hanging on the cusp of recollection, a memory of things that hadn't happened. Footnote. And there was the matter of Dick Turpin. It looked like the same car, except that forever afterwards, it seemed able to do 250 miles on a gallon of petrol, ran so quietly that you practically had to put your mouth over the exhaust pipe to see if the engine was firing, and issued its voice-synthesized warnings in a series of exquisite and perfectly phrased haikus, each one original and apt. Late frost burns the bloom. Would a fool not let the belt restrain the body? It would say. And the cherry blossom tumbles from the highest tree. One needs more petrol. A memory of things that hadn't happened. How could you have that? He sat staring at the wall until a knock at the door brought him back to earth. There was a small, dapper man in a black raincoat standing on the doorstep. He was holding a cardboard box, and he gave Newt a bright smile.
Mister,
he consulted a piece of paper in one hand.
Pulsifer?
Pulsifer, said Newt. It's a hard S.
I'm ever so sorry, said the man. I've only ever seen it written down. Well then, it would appear that this is for you and Mrs. Pulsifer.
Newt gave him a blank look.
There is no Mrs. Pulsifer, he said coldly.
The man removed his bowler hat.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, he said. I mean, there's my mother, said Newt, but she's not dead, she's just in Dorking. I'm not married. How odd. The letter is quite specific.
Who are you? Said Newt. He was wearing only his trousers, and it was chilly on the doorstep. The man balanced the box awkwardly and fished out a card from an inner pocket. He handed it to Newt. Giles Baddicombe, Roby Roby Redfern and Bychance Solicitors, 13 Demdike Chambers, Preston.
Yes,
he said politely.